A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I've got skin in the game. He's asking about hypnosis, the actual deal, what the evidence says, and where it's made a real difference in people's lives. And I confess, I once sat through a 40-minute YouTube video that promised to cure my fear of dogs through a hypnotic trance induced by audio alone. It did absolutely nothing. I still cross the street when I see a golden retriever. But that failure is kind of the perfect entry point, because it exposes the gap between the pop culture version of hypnosis and what's actually happening in clinical research. And that gap has never been wider, or more consequential. Self-hypnosis apps are booming. ASMR-adjacent content blurs the line. In a 2024 meta-analysis in the Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology, just showed hypnosis outperforming standard care for IBS by 40%. So the question isn't whether hypnosis is real, it's why the evidence keeps piling up while the perception stays stuck in swinging pendulum territory.
Your YouTube experience is the control group for this entire episode, because it demonstrates exactly what most people get wrong. You sat there passively, listening to a generic audio track designed for nobody in particular, and expected your brain to just, "That's not how this works."
I was very compliant. I was lying down and everything.
You were compliant in the wrong direction. Let's define what we're actually talking about. Hypnosis is not sleep, and it's not unconsciousness. It's a state of heightened focus and suggestibility where the subject remains fully aware and in control. You can't be made to cluck like a chicken unless some part of you is willing to cluck like a chicken. The American Medical Association endorsed hypnosis as a therapeutic tool in 1958. That's nearly 70 years ago, and it's covered by some insurance plans for pain management today. So we have this bizarre situation where the clinical establishment has been quietly saying, yes, this works for decades, while the cultural image is still stage performers and swinging pocket watches.
The credibility gap is the whole engine here. It feels like pseudoscience, but it's got an AMA stamp and peer-reviewed fMRI studies behind it. That tension is exactly what Daniel's question gets at. It feels voodoo, but the evidence is serious.
We should trace this through three layers. First, what's actually happening in the brain during hypnosis, the distinct neural mechanism that makes it measurable, not mystical. Then the strongest clinical evidence for pain, IBS, and phobias. And finally, what this means for your dog situation and for anyone listening who's considering hypnosis.
Let's start under the hood. What's actually happening in the brain when someone is hypnotized?
This is where David Spiegel's work at Stanford comes in. He's been running fMRI studies on hypnotized subjects, and what he found, published in Scientific American back in 2016, is that hypnosis produces a distinct, measurable brain state. It's not relaxation. It's not meditation. It's its own thing. During hypnosis, you see reduced activity in the default mode network. That's the brain's background chatter, the self-referential thinking, the inner monologue that's constantly evaluating and judging. At the same time, you get increased connectivity between the executive control network and the salience network. The executive control network handles focused attention and decision-making. The salience network decides what's important. When those two start talking more directly, the brain becomes extraordinarily focused while simultaneously less self-critical.
The inner editor shuts up, but the focusing mechanism stays online.
That's exactly the right image. The part of your brain that normally says, that's ridiculous, or this isn't real, gets quieted, while the part that can immerse itself in an experience gets amplified. Spiegel's team identified three distinct components. 1. Reduced activity in the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. That's involved in evaluating and monitoring errors. 2. Increased connectivity between the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the insula. That's the brain-body connection strengthening. And 3, decrease connectivity between the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the default mode network, which is essentially the brain disconnecting its executive functions from its self-narrative.
When the stage hypnotist tells someone they're freezing cold and they start shivering, their brain is actually experiencing something neurologically distinct from just pretending.
And this brings us to the mechanism that explains why your YouTube video failed. The hypnotic induction process, getting someone into that state, requires what's called quieting the critical factor. That's the part of your mind that evaluates incoming suggestions and rejects them if they don't match reality. But here's the thing. Induction is not passive. It requires active participation. You have to visualize, engage, follow the instructions with your attention. It's more like learning to enter a specific mental state than being put into one.
I was definitely just lying there, waiting for the magic to happen.
Which is what most people do. And the audio track probably gave generic suggestions. You are safe around dogs, you feel calm around dogs, without any personalized calibration to your specific fear, your level of hypnotizability, or the particular triggers that set you off. Clinical hypnosis tailors the suggestions to the individual. The practitioner assesses what you're actually afraid of. Is it the barking, the teeth, the unpredictability, and constructs suggestions that address those specific fears and language that resonates with you.
The YouTube video was like a one-size-fits-all poncho when I needed a tailored suit.
A poncho that you weren't even actively putting on, you were just standing there hoping it would drape itself over you.
All right, but here's the next layer. Why can some people be hypnotized and others can't? Because I've heard this before. Some people are just more susceptible.
This is one of the most robust findings in the field. The Stanford Hypnotic Susceptibility Scale has been around for decades, and it consistently shows that about 10 to 15% of people are highly hypnotizable. They can enter deep trance states easily and respond strongly to suggestions. Another 10 to 15% are nearly resistant. They show almost no response no matter what you do, and the remaining 70% or so fall somewhere in the middle. They can benefit from hypnosis, but it takes more practice and more skilled induction.
Is it genetic?
Twin studies suggest a heritable component, and the trait correlates strongly with something called absorption. The tendency to become fully immersed in mental imagery, to lose yourself in a book or a movie, to be so engaged in an experience that you forget your surroundings. If you're the kind of person who cries at films or jumps at scary scenes, you're probably higher in absorption, and you're probably more hypnotizable.
I do cry at films, but the YouTube video still didn't work.
Because absorption is necessary but not sufficient. You also need the right induction, the right suggestions, and active engagement. It's like having a high VO2 max. You've got the physiological potential to be a good runner, but you still need to actually train.
Alright, so the brain state is real. The individual variation is real. Let's get to the mechanism that I find genuinely fascinating. How hypnosis actually blocks pain. Because this is where it stops being theoretical and starts being medicine.
This is the dissociation mechanism, and it's remarkable. Hypnosis can temporarily separate the sensory component of pain from the emotional distress attached to it. You still feel the sensation, the signal is still arriving, but the suffering, the "this is terrible and I need it to stop" part gets dialed down. A 2024 study in the Journal of Pain looked at fibromyalgia patients and found that hypnosis reduced pain intensity by an average of 30%. That's comparable to some medications.
30% is not nothing. That's a clinically meaningful difference.
The mechanism is what distinguishes it from placebo. Placebo analgesia, when you feel less pain because you believe you've received treatment, works primarily through the endogenous opioid system. Your brain releases its own natural painkillers. Hypnotic analgesia involves both opioid and non-opioid pathways. Specifically, the anterior cingulate cortex modulates pain perception directly, and you can see this on fMRI. The ACC shows altered activity patterns during hypnotic pain relief that are distinct from what you see with placebo. If you block opioids with naloxone in a placebo responder, the placebo effect disappears. If you block opioids in someone using hypnotic analgesia, you only partially reduce the effect, because there's a non-opioid component still working.
It's not just placebo in a measurable pharmacological sense.
And this is where a lot of the skepticism falls apart. Critics will say, it's all suggestion, it's all in your head, and the answer is, yes, It is in your head in the literal sense of being a measurable brain state with distinct neural pathways. The fact that it involves subjective experience doesn't make it fake. Pain itself is subjective.
That's the thing. Pain is already in your head. That's where pain lives. So a technique that works on the brain's pain processing circuitry is working on exactly the right organ.
The clinical evidence keeps accumulating. Let me walk through the big ones. For pain management, a 2022 analysis in JAMA Internal Medicine covered 20 randomized controlled trials and found that hypnosis reduced pain by a clinically significant margin in 70% of the studies, with effects lasting up to 6 months. That's not a small effect, and it's not a short-term placebo response that fades after a few days.
70% of studies showing a real effect. That's the kind of number that would make a pharmaceutical company very happy.
For IBS, the evidence is even stronger. The 2024 analysis in the Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology, this is one of the top medical journals in the world, found that hypnosis reduced symptom severity by 40% compared to standard care. For a condition that's notoriously difficult to treat, where patients often cycle through multiple medications with limited success, that's a robust effect size. Gut-directed hypnotherapy is now a recognized, evidence-based treatment for IBS.
What does gut-directed mean in this context? Are you hypnotizing someone's intestines?
You're giving suggestions that target gut function specifically, visualizing the gut as calm, smooth, functioning normally. The brain-gut axis is a real thing, and hypnosis can modulate it. Patients learn to imagine warmth and calm in their abdomen to visualize the digestive process working smoothly. It sounds woo, but the clinical outcomes are solid.
The brain-gut axis is one of those phrases that sounds like a wellness influencer slogan until you realize it's a legitimate area of neurogastroenterology.
That's the recurring theme with hypnosis. It sounds like pseudoscience right up until you look at the data. Now let's talk about phobias, because this is where Daniel's question gets personal.
My failed YouTube experiment.
Phobias are less studied under hypnosis than pain or IBS, but there's relevant evidence. A 2023 randomized controlled trial in the Journal of Anxiety Disorders looked specifically at dog phobia. They compared a single session of hypnosis combined with exposure therapy against 8 sessions of CBT alone. The hypnosis plus exposure group showed a 50% reduction in phobia symptoms at 3-month follow-up, comparable to the CBT group.
One session of hypnosis combined with exposure matched 8 sessions of CBT?
Comparable outcomes, yes. But I need to add the caveats because the study was small, only 48 participants, and the effect was strongest in highly hypnotizable individuals. This is not a blanket claim that one hypnosis session cures phobias. It's evidence that for the right person, with the right practitioner, hypnosis can accelerate the effects of exposure therapy.
One session versus 8 is a meaningful difference in time and cost, even with a small sample.
It makes mechanistic sense. Exposure therapy works by teaching the brain that the feared stimulus isn't actually dangerous. You need repeated, safe encounters to rewire the fear response. Hypnosis can create vivid, immersive mental exposures that the brain processes as real experiences. If you're highly hypnotizable and can feel yourself calmly petting a dog in a hypnotic state, that's a form of exposure that doesn't require a physical dog.
Which brings us back to the YouTube video. Why did that fail so spectacularly when the clinical evidence for phobia treatment exists?
First, most self-hypnosis content on YouTube is unregulated, unvalidated, and produced by people with no clinical credentials. There's no quality control. Second, the induction is generic. It's not calibrated to your level of hypnotizability or your specific fear triggers. Third, and this is crucial, there's no therapeutic relationship. Clinical hypnosis involves a trained practitioner who observes your responses, adjusts the suggestions in real time, and knows when to deepen the trance versus when to back off. An audio track can't do any of that.
It's the difference between a recording of someone saying calm down and an actual therapist who can see that you're not calming down and change their approach.
And fourth, the suggestions in a YouTube video are usually one-size-fits-all affirmations. You are safe. You are calm. Dogs are friendly. If your specific fear is about being bitten, if you have a vivid mental image of teeth and blood, a generic dogs are friendly suggestion doesn't touch that. A clinical hypnotherapist would work with that specific image, perhaps suggesting that you can observe the dog from a safe distance, that you can notice its body language is relaxed, that you can feel your own body remaining calm as you watch.
The failure wasn't hypnosis, it was the delivery mechanism.
The lack of active participation. Clinical hypnosis is a skill you learn, not a state you're passively put into. The induction process teaches you how to enter that focused state, and you get better at it with practice. Even if you're not naturally highly hypnotizable, repeated practice with guided inductions can improve your responsiveness over time.
I've been approaching this like a pill I could swallow, not like a skill I needed to practice.
That's the most common misconception. People think hypnosis is something done to them rather than something they learn to do. The hypnotherapist is a coach, not a magician.
All right, let me push on something. You mentioned the placebo distinction earlier, but I want to go deeper. How do we know hypnosis isn't just an elaborate placebo response dressed up in neuroscience language?
This is a fair question, and the answer is in the mechanism. Placebo analgesia works through expectation and conditioning. You believe you're getting treatment, so your brain releases endogenous opioids. If you give someone naloxone, which blocks opioid receptors, the placebo effect disappears. With hypnotic analgesia, naloxone only partially blocks the pain relief. The non-opioid component remains active. That non-opioid component involves direct modulation of the anterior cingulate cortex. The brain is literally turning down the volume on pain processing through a different pathway.
If placebo is a single-lane road, hypnosis is a two-lane highway, and one of those lanes doesn't care about opioid blockers.
That's a solid image. And there's another distinction. Placebo effects tend to be short-lived and highly context-dependent. The JAMA analysis found hypnotic pain relief lasting up to 6 months. That's not a transient expectation effect. That's a learned skill that patients continue to use.
The durability is a strong argument against the just placebo dismissal.
And I should add, the placebo effect itself is real and powerful. Calling something just placebo is a weird way of dismissing a genuine neurobiological phenomenon. But hypnosis is measurably distinct from it.
Where does this leave the listener who's hearing all this evidence and thinking, maybe I should try this? What's the practical path?
First, if you're considering hypnosis for a specific issue, pain, IBS, phobia, seek a certified clinical hypnotherapist, not a YouTube video or a stage hypnotist. In the United States, look for practitioners with credentials from the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis or the Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. These organizations require licensed healthcare professionals, psychologists, physicians, dentists, social workers, who have additional training in hypnosis.
You're not going to a hypnotist. You're going to a licensed therapist who happens to have hypnosis training.
And many CBT practitioners have this training. If you're already seeing a therapist for anxiety or a phobia, ask them if they're trained in hypnotic techniques. It's increasingly common.
What about the apps? You mentioned the self-hypnosis boom.
There are some that are research-backed and worth trying. Reverie was developed by David Spiegel's lab at Stanford, the same Spiegel who did the fMRI research we discussed. It includes personalized induction elements and is based on validated protocols. HypnoVR is used in clinical settings, particularly in Europe, and has published research behind it. These are a meaningful step above random YouTube videos because they're built on actual clinical protocols and include some degree of personalization.
They're still not a replacement for a trained practitioner.
They're a complement, not a replacement. Think of them the way you'd think of a meditation app versus a meditation teacher. The app can teach you the basics and help you practice, but if you're dealing with a specific clinical issue, you want the human expert.
For phobia specifically, you said hypnosis works best as an adjunct to exposure therapy.
The evidence suggests hypnosis can accelerate and enhance exposure therapy, particularly for highly hypnotizable individuals. It's not a standalone cure. If you have a dog phobia, you should be working with a therapist who does exposure therapy and who can integrate hypnotic techniques into that process. The hypnosis helps you do the exposure work more effectively. It doesn't replace it.
My path forward, if I actually want to deal with this dog thing, is find a CBT therapist with hypnosis training, do the exposure work, and use hypnosis to make that exposure work more effective.
That's exactly what the evidence supports. And you need to be an active participant, visualizing, engaging, practicing the induction techniques. No lying on the couch waiting for a YouTube voice to fix you.
I feel attacked.
I'm a retired pediatrician. I've spent decades telling people things they don't want to hear in the gentlest possible way.
The gentle donkey approach.
It's a recognized therapeutic modality.
Let's pull back for a moment. What's the biggest misconception you want to knock down before we wrap up the evidence section?
That hypnosis is something done to you rather than something you learn. The stage show image. The hypnotist snaps their fingers and you're under their control, has done enormous damage to public understanding. You cannot be made to do something against your will under hypnosis. You remain aware and in control the entire time. It's a collaborative process between practitioner and patient, and the patient is doing most of the work.
The hypnotist is the guide, not the driver.
And the second misconception is that hypnosis is a magical cure-all. It works best for specific conditions, pain, IBS, phobias, anxiety, smoking cessation, and even then, it's usually most effective as part of a broader treatment plan. Anyone promising to cure your depression or your trauma with a single hypnosis session is selling something.
The specificity matters. It's not a universal brain hack.
It's a tool with specific applications, backed by specific evidence, for specific conditions. The more we treat it as medicine and less as magic, the more useful it becomes.
Let's synthesize this into something actionable. For the listener who's been following along and thinking about trying hypnosis, what are the concrete steps?
Step 1. Identify what you want to treat. Is it chronic pain, IBS, a specific phobia, anxiety? Hypnosis has the strongest evidence for pain and IBS, growing evidence for phobias and anxiety. Step 2. Find a certified practitioner through ASCH or SCEH, someone who is already a licensed healthcare professional with additional hypnosis training. Step 3. Understand that this is a skill you'll need to practice. Even if you're not naturally highly hypnotizable, responsiveness can improve with training. The key is active participation. Visualizing, engaging, not just listening passively.
Step 4. Don't expect a single session to fix everything. The evidence shows effects building over multiple sessions, and the best outcomes come when hypnosis is integrated with other evidence-based treatments.
Step 5. If you want to start with an app, choose one with research backing. Reverie or HypnoVR, and treat it as practice, not treatment. It can teach you the basics of self-hypnosis, but it's not a substitute for clinical care if you have a serious condition.
For phobias specifically, the message seems to be, find a therapist who does exposure therapy, ask if they have hypnosis training, and use the hypnosis to accelerate the exposure work.
That's the evidence-based path. And Daniel, if you're listening, your YouTube video failed because it was passive, generic, and unvalidated. That doesn't mean hypnosis can't help with your dog phobia. It means you need the real thing, not the YouTube version.
With extreme reluctance and a healthy dose of skepticism still intact.
Skepticism is healthy. The evidence can handle it.
Where does this field go next? Because I'm imagining AI-driven personalized hypnosis, apps that adapt inductions based on real-time biometric feedback, heart rate variability, maybe even EEG.
This is already emerging. The question is whether we'll see a genuine democratization of this treatment, making validated hypnosis accessible to people who can't afford or access a trained practitioner, or just a new wave of unregulated, ineffective products with good marketing. The neuroscience is clear that hypnosis is a real, measurable brain state with clinical utility. But the market is flooded with pseudoscience, and AI could amplify both the good and the bad.
The signal-to-noise problem gets harder, not easier, as the technology improves.
A well-designed AI hypnosis app built on validated protocols could be transformative. Personalized induction, real-time adaptation, evidence-based suggestions tailored to the individual. A poorly designed one is just a fancier version of your YouTube video, and consumers have almost no way to tell the difference.
That's the tension. We have the tools. Spiegel's lab has published protocols. The clinical evidence is solid. The mechanisms are understood. But adoption lags behind the evidence, and the market fills the gap with nonsense.
Which is why episodes like this matter. The more people understand what hypnosis actually is and what the evidence actually says, the better equipped they are to separate the clinical tool from the theatrical performance.
My dog phobia might not be cured by a YouTube video, but the evidence suggests that with the right approach, a certified practitioner, active participation, and integration with exposure, therapy hypnosis could be a valuable tool.
That's the headline. Hypnosis is a real, measurable brain state with distinct neural mechanisms and a growing body of clinical evidence. It's not a party trick, and it's not a cure-all. But for the right person, with the right practitioner, for the right condition, it works.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, Azorean whalers measured rope for harpoon lines using the Portuguese whaler's knot length, where one knot length equaled the wingspan of the ship's youngest crew member, typically about 5 feet, meaning a standard 200-knot-length harpoon line stretched roughly 1,000 feet, though it varied by ship depending on which boy they measured.
Right? The future of hypnosis is going to be fascinating to watch, especially as the AI tools mature and the evidence base expands. The challenge won't be proving it works. It'll be helping people find the signal in the noise.
If you're curious about this topic, the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis website is a good place to start. They have a practitioner directory and solid educational resources.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.